live from Cap Radio in Sacramento. This is Insight. I'm your host, Randall White. Today, we have a mix of politics and COVID for you, as those are the two big stories dominating the week. Much of the U.S. is seeing a major surge in COVID cases, as are parts of California. So we'll check in with an expert who can help us get a sense of how first responders are coping after more than a half year of nonstop trauma. Also, we'll look at how California and a few other Western states are approaching safety measures around a potential COVID vaccine and take a deep look into the vaccine development process with one of the state's top experts out of UCLA. But first, with less than a week now before Election Day, how are the state government races shaping up? Polling suggests California could break some records when it comes to the margin of victory for a presidential candidate, as well as dominance of the Democratic Party at the state capitol. Cap Radio's politics reporter and co-host of the California State of Mind podcast, a partnership with Cal Matters, Nicole Nixon, joins us today to help get us up to speed. Hey, Nicole.
Hi, good morning.
Yeah, good morning. So can you lay out for us what's currently going on with legislative races this year?
Yeah, so all of the assembly seats are up for election and half the Senate seats are up. So California has obviously been a blue state for a while. The legislature's been under Democratic control since the 70s. But we still saw that blue wave in 2018 and a few Orange County legislative congressional districts change hands, some seats in the Central Valley too. So what will be interesting to see this year is whether that trend continues with the presidential election and the effect that that, you know, top ticket race will have on down ballot races. Mm. I think that Orange County is sort of the new battleground for legislative and congressional seats. And so in the state house, there are a handful of vulnerable Republicans that are kind of seeing their districts change around them and their Democratic opponents are raising more money. There's this unpopular president, at least in California, at the top of the Republican ticket. So they have to be worried this cycle.
Are there one or two races that have caught your eye either with either congressional or state house?
Yeah, so there are some races in that Orange County area, like I mentioned. There's one seat in particular that I'm looking at. It's currently held by Lingling Chang. She's a Republican in this district that encompasses Eastern LA County, also parts of Orange County and San Bernardino County. It's a longtime Republican held seat. Chang first ran for the seat in 2016. She was in the assembly at the time, but she lost to her Democratic opponent. And that lawmaker, his name is Josh Newman, was recalled just 2 years later after voting for the gas tax increase.
That's right.
So Chang won the seat back in the 20, or not back, she won the seat in the 2018 recall. Now the two are back in a rematch. So Newman's won the seat before, and he's raised a ton of money this time, but he was recalled. And now Chang has the incumbent advantage. So it will be a really interesting matchup.
Yeah. Okay, in California, Democrats have a majority at the state capitol, as you pointed out, holding all publicly elected offices at the top and maintaining a supermajority in both houses of the legislature. Can you explain what that means and how the mix of Democrats and Republicans could change after the election?
Yeah, so Democrats already have a supermajority. That is a technical term that means a two-thirds majority. And certain bills, tax increases, for example, also overriding a governor's veto, those kinds of things need a two-thirds majority vote. So when one party has that clear line of majority, it just makes it easier, at least, you know, kind of in theory, not always, because there are like more anti-tax Democrats. It depends on the lawmaker, but, you know, having a clear party majority helps move a party agenda in some way. So what will be interesting to see after this election is whether Democrats pick up even more seat and sort of continue that blue wave into 2020 and keep it going. One thing we do know is that Republicans will pick up at least one assembly seat. This is actually more of a take back since it was one of those seats that flipped in the 2018 midterms. Mm. And that's the one that's currently held by Democrat Christy Smith. She's running for Congress this year. She flipped that district in 2018. And the two, since she's in this congressional race, the top two primary finishers for that seat are both Republicans. So that's a seat that the GOP can count on this year.
What are members of both parties saying as to why all of this matters? What is of most importance heading into November?
Yeah, well, I asked the two party officials that this week, you know, with the presidential race going on, I asked, how are you sort of making your case to voters for your legislative candidates? And the Democratic Party chairman said that, you know, certainly Democrats are hoping that their down ballot candidates, you know, state lawmakers, congressional candidates, even county supervisor candidates will benefit from Californians turning out for Joe Biden. The deputy executive director of the California Republican Party, Brian Watkins, gave me a pretty interesting answer. Here's what he said.
You know, we've known from day one that this was going to be a presidential year. And so we wanted to, at the California Republican Party, build an operation that whether the president had 90% approval or he had 10% approval, that, you know, could provide the best possible operation for our legislative candidates that it could.
To me, it was pretty stunning to hear a party official say out loud that they were planning on what to do if their party leader, the president of the United States, had a 10% approval rating. I think it just speaks to Trump's unpopularity here in California. And it also shows that there's a nervousness among California Republicans about the state of national politics and a desire to kind of distance themselves from all of that in order to focus on local races and issues happening here at home. And then the other thing that I'll just say is that, you know, Republicans don't have a lot of power in the legislature. Like, I don't think anybody expects for a Republican majority to happen anytime soon, but they've really, these Republican lawmakers really see themselves as a check on the administration and the legislative majority, the Democrats that are in power in the state house. And the more and more seats that Democrats pick up, I think you could argue that the harder and harder it would be for their control over the state of, you know, state politics and lawmaking to loosen. In a supermajority situation, the negotiations that normally happen be on things like a state budget, certain, you know, consequential bills, those big negotiations aren't happening between Republicans and Democrats. They're more happening between like factions of the controlling party, you know, pro-business Democrats versus more labor-friendly Democrats, progressives versus moderates. So those are the really interesting battles that kind of play out in supermajority legislatures in really interesting way. Of course, that's not really new to California.
Are there moderate members of the Republican Party that hold elected office in California that are also taking part in some of these negotiations?
Well, the Republican leaders are certainly involved on some level. But I think that, you know, when your minority is so small, it's just much easier for you to just be left out of those important conversations.
Yeah. Nicole, I want to spend a couple of minutes talking about your new podcast, because I am a voracious podcast listener. Like, I just gobble them up all day long. I love podcasts. And the new podcast that Cap Radio has partnered with Cal Matters on, of which you are a co-host, is terrific. There's a couple of episodes that are already out. And I just want, I know that it's sort of in its soft launch phase, so we're not like doing a whole segment on it or anything like that. But if you could just give people a sense of what California State of Mind is about.
Yeah, well, we are all about explaining what's going on in state government and state politics and how it affects your daily life. And I know that that sounds kind of, that might sound a little cheesy, but I think this year with the coronavirus, we've really noticed, and it's gotten to a whole new level kind of with how much influence decisions made at government levels can affect your life, you know, whether you can go shopping inside a store or whether you can eat a restaurant patio or inside, or you have to get takeout. And so we're hoping to explain those kinds of decisions in a way that makes sense for everyday people who aren't necessarily political junkies. And of course, there's a lot of election stuff going on right now. So we're looking at voting and how to do that and how to make sure your vote is counted, at least until the election.
So I left a review at Apple Podcasts.
And, thank you.
And the one of the terms that I used is digestible, because I just think that the way it is written and presented, like you said, if you're not a political junkie, you get it. Like you really boil it down. And I'm not sure how much of the production process is devoted to that, but it seems like there's a lot to make things that are complex easy to understand. And I just have to say hats off. And then when I started looking through the other people who had, you know, posted comments, a lot of people use that same term, easy to digest, you know. So just yeah. great work, Nicole.
Thank you so much. Thanks, Randall.
Yeah, and our partnership with CalMatters, I think, is terrific. In fact, we have a CalMatters guest coming up here in just a little bit. So Cap Radio's politics reporter and co-host of the California State of Mind podcast, Nicole Nixon. Always great to catch up with you. And this is definitely the week to do some catching up. So thank you.
Thanks.
And now I want to just take a moment to revisit a segment that we had on Monday's show. It was about this same time, discussing Sacramento's Measure A. For a quick recap, Measure A would essentially change the city's council manager form of government to a mayor council form, meaning the mayor would have more power. And we heard from you some of you anyway, who wanted us to clarify how the mayor, city council, and city manager participate in the city's budget process. So I reached out to the city to get clarification and then spoke with one of the state's top experts when it comes to city finance. Michael Coleman runs CaliforniaCityFinance.com and says Sacramento's mayor actually has quite a bit of influence over the budget process currently, on par with the rest of the city council.
And they give direction to the city manager about their priorities and their policies. And they do that with the input and listening to their constituents. And then the manager takes that guidance and prepares a proposed budget, which is then put through an extensive budget process, including public hearings and lots of involvement by citizens. And then the city manager takes further direction from the city council and the members about how that proposed budget should be redrafted and altered and amended. And then the budget, in order to be passed and put into effect, must receive the majority approval of the full city council.
So Coleman goes on to say that under Measure A's mayor-council system, the mayor would be the person who proposes a budget.
Rather than going to a city manager who reports to all members of the city council, the staff preparing that would be reporting to the mayor. And so it vests considerably more authority and influence in the mayor's position rather than distributed among all the city council members.
So again, that's city finance expert Michael Coleman. A big thanks to him for helping give us some clarity. So I hope that adds to our Measure A conversation from Monday. And I really want to thank those of you who contacted us regarding the show. And this serves as a great reminder that if you ever want to comment on an Insight segment or even suggest one of your own, just shoot us a note to insight@capradio.org. I really do my best to respond to every single one that we get. Also, there is much more on Measure A and many of the other ballot measures and propositions and candidates at capradio.org. In terms of Measure A, we do have interviews with both sides of the issue there. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio. I'm Randall White, and in just a moment, we'll be talking coronavirus vaccine. It's become very politicized, and the West Coast is taking it on its own to make sure that when the vaccine future vaccine is released, that it will have undergone additional scientific scrutiny. We'll dive into that in just a moment.
Hi, Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Randall White. The coronavirus vaccine has become a very politicized process. During the vice presidential debate, Senator and Democratic candidate for vice president Kamala Harris went as far to say this.
If the public health professionals, if Dr. Fauci, if the doctors tell us that we should take it, I'll be the first in line to take it. Absolutely. But if Donald Trump tells us that we should take it, I'm not taking it.
Governor Gavin Newsom announced earlier this week that California will have a statewide panel to review any COVID-19 vaccine that is released, regardless of which administration releases it. The panel would consist of health experts who would ensure the safety of the vaccine, and this would happen regardless of whoever wins the presidency coming up. And here to help us understand the ins and outs of this review panel is CalMatters health reporter Ana Ibarra. And Ana, welcome to Insight. Great to have you here.
Thanks, Randall.
So, Ana, can you help us understand why the governor would be concerned about the COVID-19 vaccine and why he wants to have a separate panel review its safety?
Sure. So the reason we have this is there's been concern that the Trump administration would rush through the regulatory process, ahead of the election. President Trump has been announcing for weeks, if not months now, that a COVID-19 vaccine is right around the corner. In early September, he said we could expect a vaccine to be ready in mid-October. The CDC said it could be as early as November 1st. But public health experts said this timeline has, it seems rushed and it made them both suspicious. So we've heard Governor Newsom say that this is, of course, people's lives at play. So California will be cautious and not just take the federal government's word for it.
Mm-hmm. And other states now have joined in on this review panel.
Yeah. So yesterday we learned that Washington, Oregon, and Nevada will be joining this effort and bringing on their own experts to join this panel.
Mm-hmm. And so it'll all be one big panel. Each state won't have its own.
Correct.
Uh-huh.
Yes.
And then what's the process? What's the role of the review panel? How will they go about that?
Yeah, so their job is pretty much to stay on top of the clinical trials at the federal level and review their outcomes and review safety evidence available. So it's like an extra set of eyes. Yesterday in the noon briefing, Dr. Mark Galli said that the state won't be conducting their own clinical trials or anything like that, but simply reviewing the vaccine data that is available.
Mm, okay. So one of my first thoughts when I heard this was how big of a delay is there going to be? if you've got review going on at the federal level and then it being passed down to the Western states here, I would imagine there would be a lot of pressure from businesses and tourism and everything you can think of under the umbrella to make this process not last too long.
Right. And so that's the big question. And, yesterday the governor said, no, the review process will not cause any delays. He said this would simply increase transparency and trust amongst the public. So I followed up with the public health department asking a little bit more about this. And so they told me that this work is already underway. They've started reviewing with the data that is available already. So the committee is already meeting and, public health folks said, or the public health department ensured the review committee's recommendations would be timely. So we'll see.
Mm-hmm. Ana, what do you know about in terms of how soon people might expect a vaccine?
Yeah, so we've been told, to not expect a vaccine this or in 2020, at least not most of us. If there is a vaccine, or it will be in limited supply at first. And of course, this would go to, you know, people who are at high risk, like health workers, or people who are more vulnerable, like seniors. So, you know, when I've talked to public health experts, they say, you know, a more realistic timeline is maybe mid-2021 for the general public. But of course, you know, we're all it's a moving timeline. So we'll see on that, too.
All right. Ana Ibarra is CalMatters health reporter. It's a great primer for our next guest. So thank you so much, Ana, for getting us up to speed there.
Thanks for having me, Randall.
So as the race for a COVID-19 vaccine continues, many doctors and researchers are working toward other therapies in order to help those who have contracted the virus. One such doctor is professor of medicine and associate chief of infectious diseases at the UCLA David Geffen School of Medicine, Dr. Otto Yang. He has been overseeing trials of new drugs aimed at fighting COVID-19. And Dr. Yang joins us now. And thank you for taking the time to join us and help us understand the work that's going on into creating a vaccine and other treatments. You are a very busy person, I understand. And so we appreciate you taking a few minutes this morning.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
Referencing back to our last segment there, what do you think of California, Washington, Oregon, and Nevada creating an independent review panel to test the vaccine before it's released in these states?
I think, unfortunately, it reflects the concerns about how politics have worked their way into science and to our important institutions that are supposed to be safeguarding us. So, you know, it's a political issue, which is concerning.
Yeah. And some of those institutions would include the CDC. And what does it say about our trust in those organizations?
Yeah, it definitely reflects eroded trust. The FDA, you know, in particular, is the institution that would be approving a vaccine. So I think it demonstrates that there's concern. At least, you know, by these states, that there is a loss of integrity of the system.
So help us understand the creation of a vaccine. Prior to COVID-19, the fastest that a vaccine had ever been created was, what, like 4 years or something, right, for the polio vaccine?
I believe it was the mumps vaccine back in the 1960s. Yes, it was 4 or 5 years, I recall.
Okay, mumps. And so help us understand why it would have taken 4 years that many decades ago to create a vaccine and how the current process might be different.
Yeah, so were or are multiple steps, right? So in the case of past vaccines, the first thing would be to come up with a working design of some sort. So with mumps, I believe the process was to culture the virus and find out to weaken it and to the point that it would be safe to be given to a person. So that was a live virus vaccine. And so that would take some time. And then, of course, the next step, which takes often a lot of time, is the testing phase, where there's observation of efficacy and safety, which are obviously the most important aspects of a vaccine. And then finally, it would be ramping up production to the point that there's enough to give out. So all of those steps together usually will take quite a bit of time.
Mm-hmm. And then with COVID-19, it wouldn't be a live virus, right? A weakened live virus. It would be going about it a different way.
Yes. So none of the large scale trials going on involve a live virus because of concerns about safety. So, but that's one step where some time has been saved. So there were already these platforms, particularly the RNA platform and recombinant adenovirus platforms. Those were already in place. And so once the sequence of the virus was determined very early on, it was pretty quick to plug those in to try to go in to move into those platforms to have something ready for human testing. So that a lot of time was saved there. And Now, of course, we're in the testing phase, and the question is how long that's going to take. And it's difficult to predict.
Yeah, because that's the, you know, we might have all of the DNA technology and fast computers that we didn't have decades ago. But when it comes to actually testing the virus, you can't speed that up, right? I mean, testing the vaccine, I should say.
Mm-hmm. Right, right. Exactly. You know, that's just a process that requires time. And, you know, the issue is also having enough power in the trials to make a determination about efficacy. Right. So that depends on the infection rate. So the way to tell if the vaccine works is to compare the people that got the vaccine to the people that got the placebo in these trials. And if the infection rate in the people that are getting tested is low, so if very few people get infected, then you don't have the statistical power. You can't make a good comparison if your placebo group has very few people infected. So that's makes it hard to know exactly how long this is going to take, because it depends to some extent on how frequent infections are in the people that are getting vaccinated.
Dr. Yang, what were your thoughts on the timeline? Did this seem too fast for you, or do you feel that we're setting a good pace right now?
I think it's definitely rushed, but it's rushed, but not necessarily unrealistic that there could be an answer by early next year. Mm-hmm. Again, it depends on what happens with the pandemic and how many people get infected while they're in these trials. It is something though of concern if it's too rushed, because obviously we need to have clear answers before a vaccine is given out to millions and millions of people.
Mm-hmm. How do vaccines work in the body? So I got vaccinated for the flu like a month ago, and I had a very sore arm. Mm-hmm. And I actually did experience some achiness and some, I guess, side effects. I was tired and that sort of thing for about a day. What's going on in your body when you get a vaccine?
That's actually an interesting question that you would think that we would have good answers to, but in fact, we really don't understand perfectly well exactly how vaccines work. To some extent, the history of vaccines has always been trial and error. Right. So you go back to Salk, and Salk said, well, let's take a virus and let's kill it. And then let's inject it into a person. And Sabin said, let's weaken the virus and inject it into the person. And people in the past really didn't care too much how they worked, as long as they worked. So, you know, I would say that in the modern era, that's starting with HIV, when we had a really stubborn problem where vaccines weren't working, have we really started to try to unravel that? And we still don't fully understand. There are at least two major parts of immunity that probably contribute. So one is called humoral immunity, or antibodies, right? So antibodies are molecules made by our immune system that bind to foreign materials in our body, so like viruses. And then the other arm of immunity, which we understand a bit less, is called cellular immunity. So cellular immunity are specialized immune cells that actually survey the body and look for cells that are producing viruses. Mm-hmm. And actually clear them out. And so the immune system generally, you know, part of that is inflammation. So what you were experiencing after your flu vaccine was some of the inflammation of the immune system being stimulated by seeing a foreign material in your body.
I see. And those two systems that you just mentioned work totally separately from each other, right? If I understood it correctly, you were sort of describing like people taking antibiotics for one type of thing and people getting a vaccine for something viral. Did I get that right?
Close. Yeah. I mean, again, we don't fully understand. So they are separate in terms of what they do. They are probably fairly closely intertwined in terms of interactions and control. So the immune system controls these two arms of immunity, and the components that control them interact quite a bit. So it's a complex system. And so, yes, they do separate things, but probably there's a lot of interactions that we don't fully understand.
But if you contract a virus that's making you sick, antibiotics aren't going to do you any good, right?
Correct. Yeah. Antibiotics being, you know, generally the, what we call antibiotics are antibacterial molecules that we take. And so, yes, viruses are completely different than bacteria. And the antibiotics that we take for bacteria will not help. And in fact, may hurt.
Is there concern that the coronavirus that causes COVID-19 might change or morph, evolve to a point that whatever virus we're working on right now wouldn't help? Or would the vaccine be more general than that?
Yes. So that's something that people have obviously thought about a lot and are concerned about, because if you make a vaccine and then the virus changes, then you're back at square one. Fortunately, it does look like this coronavirus has a very, very low mutation rate. So it evolves, it changes its sequence very, very slowly compared to many other viruses. Mm-hmm. And so far, there does not look like there's been enough change that it would affect vaccine development.
Okay. Coronavirus is not something new. This one is. That's why it's called novel coronavirus. But we do understand how coronavirus, or I don't know what the plural is, but how they work. Mm-hmm. And there has been ongoing research with that. But in recent years, government funding for that research has been curtailed. Is that right?
Yes. So I'm not an expert on coronaviruses. In fact, there are very few experts on coronaviruses because, for the most part, until the original SARS back in 2002, 2003, the only known coronaviruses were the four commonly circulating ones that cause very mild illness in most people. Basically, they cause common colds. So there wasn't a whole lot of interest and much effort devoted to studying them. There hasn't been a huge amount of coronavirus research, and we actually don't understand that well how that virus, how this family of viruses works. They're very large, complex viruses. So their genetic material is about 30,000 bases, which is fairly large compared to, say, HIV, that's less than 10,000 bases. And we still don't fully understand how HIV works, despite huge amounts of research and interest.
Yeah, I mean, there's a virus that's been around for decades, and we don't have a cure.
We still don't have a cure. We still don't understand what all the genes do fully. This is something that we're only starting to scratch the surface of.
Doctor, as you know, there is a vocal anti-vaccine movement in this country. What happens if large segments of the population refuse to vaccinate for COVID-19, either because they're part of this movement or because they just don't trust its origins, as we discussed earlier?
Yeah, that's clearly a significant problem, because the efficacy of vaccines. So part of the efficacy of a vaccine is, of course, protecting the individual. But another huge factor in protecting people is herd immunity, right? So herd immunity basically protects those of us who cannot be vaccinated or in whom a vaccine won't work because of compromised immune system, for example. So that depends on a large percentage of people getting vaccinated so that the virus can no longer circulate in the population. So if a significant percentage of people in our population do not get vaccinated, then herd immunity will not be achievable, and the virus will continue to circulate.
Doctor, you and other researchers are working toward other therapies in order to help with the condition of COVID-19. Give us some insight there. What are we working on that's outside of the vaccine world?
Yes. So there are two major strategies to deal with treatment. So this coronavirus causes disease in through two phases. So the first phase is the virus starting to replicate in the body, and that tends to be a fairly mild phase. So someone may have no symptoms or may have mild symptoms. And then after that, many people will get better, but some people will progress to severe or critical disease. And that's a highly inflammatory phase where it appears that the immune system is overreacting to the presence of the virus. So if you think about it, then there are two main strategies. One is direct antiviral agents. So giving medications that have activity to stop the virus. So remdesivir is the key example of that and has shown some success. And then the second strategy is to try to tamp down or reduce the amount of inflammation or immune response against the virus, since at that point, the immune response is doing more harm than good. And so many agents are being tried for that. But the one that's shown some promise so far is basically steroids. So dexamethasone has been shown to reduce mortality in severe disease. So different agents now. So we have, you know, prototype agents, remdesivir antiviral and dexamethasone for reducing the immune response. But, you know, there's a lot of room to improve. And so further research is focused on finding better agents in both of those classes.
And in a way, these other ways of treating COVID-19 would be similar to HIV in a sense that they're more getting rid of the symptoms and the problems than actually getting rid of the virus.
Well, HIV is a little different because HIV has what's called latency. So there, you can't. So far, there's no way to remove the virus from the body once it's established, because it can hide in the DNA of cells. But for this virus, actually, it's an RNA virus that doesn't go through a DNA phase. So it potentially is possible to clear this virus out of somebody. And that appears to be what happens naturally. So
okay.
A person who's infected does clear the virus out.
Do we know enough yet about novel coronavirus to have a sense of the long-term effects?
We do not. So there are lots of reports of patients who have long-term symptoms. I think that the kind of the term that they're using to apply to themselves are long haulers. So in the long haul, they have symptoms, and we still do not understand why that is. But it does look like there, in some people at least, there are long-term symptoms, and we don't know how long that will last, since this has only been around for less than a year. So yeah, we don't have much data.
Professor of Medicine and Associate Chief of Infectious Diseases at the UCLA David Geffen School of Medicine, Dr. Otto Yang, we really appreciate you taking the time to share your information with us this morning. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
Still ahead, with the pandemic surging after an already intense year of cases, plus here in California anyway, wildfires, first responders are once again facing nonstop trauma. We'll take a closer look at the mental health issues for first responders in California. Shoot us an email at any time to insight@capradio.org, or you can use the Twitter hashtag #AskInsight. We always love to hear from you. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Randall White, and we're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Randall White. It is estimated that nearly a third of all first responders develop behavioral health conditions, including depression and post-traumatic stress disorder, and there are others. This is according to a recent report by the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, which says the general population, for comparison, sees a rate of about 20%, so about one in five. That report was published in 2018, so that's important because it's pre-pandemic. Now, we've been dealing with COVID-19 for the better part of 8 months, so we think about our health heroes on the front lines, you know, doctors and nurses and hospital staff. Plus, we live in California, and we all know the devastation wildfires have caused, so we think about the heroic work of our firefighters and what they're doing to keep us safe. So when you add it all up, being a first responder on any day, but especially these days, can be tough, and we know many of them are struggling. Dr. Tam Nguyen is the director of ambulatory care with Sutter's Mental Health and Addiction Care Team, and she joins us today to give us some insight into this. It's great to have you here, doctor. Thank you.
Good morning. It's great to be here with you.
So that 2018 report that I cited, doctor, says 30% of first responders struggle with some form of behavioral health issue. In your line of work, do you think that that's accurate?
I do. You know, I think as healthcare providers and also in other professions where you're sort of have an increased rate of experiencing situations that are that place your own safety at risk, that it makes a lot of sense that mm-hmm. naturally you'll also have a higher risk or likelihood of experiencing mental health symptoms like depression or increased anxiety or post-traumatic stress disorder.
Do you think, since that report was done a couple of years ago, do you think that those numbers have pushed higher because of the pandemic and the increase in wildfires and everything that we've been seeing?
You know, I think that's a little more difficult to sort of say, yes, naturally that would be the case, because there's this other, the other side of the coin is that as humans, we're also quite resilient. Mm-hmm. And there's a sort of natural selection for many folks who go into these health types of professions where it brings them a sense of accomplishment and achievement when they're doing this type of work where they're supporting others, helping out their community. So in some ways, it actually helps them build their resiliency. And so I think the question will be that it'll be interesting to see what the data reflects and how individuals respond to the increased levels of stress that we're experiencing as a community together today, and then particularly for those that are in these types of professions. So I think it's actually more difficult to say. My guess would be it'll be interesting to see how that actually flows out. And the reason that I say that is even within the mental health department, when the pandemic first happened, what we saw was an increase in patients accessing mental health services, but they were saying, I'm doing okay, I'm actually feeling like I'm able to manage this, I'm supporting my family and friends. And then as it progressed, what we saw was a dip and sort of the ability to self-manage or cope. And we're starting to sort of see that kind of level out again. And so there's sort of this dip and, you know, and an increase. And so it'll be interesting to see what happens over time with that. Because this is a sort of unknown and unexpected situation. I don't know if we've got a good template or data to sort of give us a good sense of what might happen.
That's an excellent point, Dr. Nguyen, regarding the that resilience, that benefit, that bonus that you get from helping mm-hmm. others. We had an expert on yesterday from Stanford University to talk about election-related stress. And he had said something very similar, that if you're feeling, you know, the heavy burden of the election, first of all, look away from the news and then do something that you feel is positive and physically do it. Don't just click a retweet or something like that, but physically mm-hmm. do it, and you should get some benefit from that. And that's essentially what you're saying.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think there's so much benefit to us thinking about what's important to us. You know, we're really talking about values, and how do we take actions each day as we move towards those values. They don't have to be huge things. We're not saving the world today. But what's one thing we're doing? We're saying hi to our neighbor who maybe didn't have a chance, hasn't had a chance to see her family or friends as much because of shelter in place and what's happening. And so we're extending ourselves and building that social connection. And those are the ways, you know, they sort of add up over time. And as we see the results of that, it really helps us, that also motivates us to continue to do that and to see that there is still hope despite the challenges that we faced day to day. And of course, some of the acute situations, unexpected situations as well.
Yeah. I live in a neighborhood adjacent to a hospital, and I see so many signs in people's yards thanking the first responders. Mm-hmm. I imagine that has to help on some level as well, too.
Yeah, absolutely. Those are, you know, just sort of constant reminders, or they're helpful reminders for those of us who might be driving home from a tough day. Mm-hmm. And to say, yes, we're being recognized and acknowledged for the difficult work and that we're doing now, and maybe even a little more difficult than it typically is during current times.
Yeah, I certainly don't expect you to share any names or anything along those lines. But I'm wondering if you can share what you see there at Sutter with staff who are on the front lines, be it nurses or doctors, paramedics, over the past, you know, 8 months-ish when it's come to COVID, what have been some of your experiences there?
Yeah, I mean, I think first and foremost, whatever our backgrounds or professions are, we're sort of human, right? And we experience the daily challenges of being a parent, of being a partner, of being a spouse, of being a friend, just like anyone else or the patients that we serve in our care centers. And so I think one of the things that I've noticed is we've all tried to remind each other, hey, we're stronger together. So, and we recognize that this is one of those unusual circumstances where we as healthcare providers are also going through the same challenges as our patients. And so how can we help support one another in our workplace community? And let us know, right? Lean in to each other and support one another. And I think that that's been really helpful in helping manage the sort of increased anxiety and challenges that we all have, just like our patients have with managing distance learning for our kids and remote working. Caring and not being able to see our elderly parents as much, et cetera, those types of things. But really sort of saying, hey, we're a work family. And so how can we support each other as we're supporting our patients so that we can ensure we're continuing to provide the best care for those folks that we care for? It reminds me a little bit like when you're in an airplane and you're getting ready to head off, you know, and they say, remember, if there's a situation, put on your mask first, your oxygen mask first before that of, you know, your neighbor or your children. And that's because if we're not, you know, healthy and well, we can't support those around us.
Oh, that's a great analogy. I like that. So often, Dr. Nguyen, when there is an event that would cause a surge at the hospital, it is short-lived for the most part. This is something that continually goes on. And mm-hmm. as we just heard from the previous doctor, a vaccine might not be here until the middle of next year, if then. So this is something that we know will continue moving mm-hmm. forward. So how do you prepare the doctors and nurses and first responders for that outlook, for knowing that you've already had a really rough 8 months, but this isn't going to end anytime soon?
Yeah, I think one of the things that we do is try to communicate as regularly and as much as possible with the team in terms of the latest information that we have. Mm-hmm. And one of that is, yes, we're starting to understand this is going to be much longer than any of us had anticipated. To really inform the team about that and then also to say, and what are things that we're doing to prepare for that? What adjustments are we making as a health system? What adjustments are we making as a frontline clinical team with the understanding that this is going to be something that we'll be managing for the next 6 months, at least at the very least, or the next year? And then also asking them, let us know, what are some ideas you have around the kinds of adjustments that need to be made, knowing that this could be going on for much longer than any of us had anticipated or expected to be going on for.
Yeah, we only have about about a minute left, but I'm wondering if in that time you could share some techniques or exercises that people can do in the moment to lessen, you know, tension and anxiety.
Yeah, one of the things that I really like, it's an easy acronym, is called Face COVID. And it's this idea that in this situation, the primary emotion that we experience is fear. And naturally with fear, what we do is hide and isolate. And so the way to manage fear is to face it or to really show up to it. Mm-hmm. So it's an easy acronym to say F equals focus on what's in your control. Okay, A is acknowledge your mm-hmm. thoughts and feelings. C is come back into your body. E is engage in what you're doing. C is committed action. O is opening up. V is values. I is identify resources. And D is disinfect and distance. So it's a really easy sort of in the moment thing that you can remember, but it's really about stay focused on what's happening in the here and now and engage in committed actions that are consistent with your values.
That's great. Doctor, can you share that with us? And then we'll post that on today's show page at capradio.org.
Absolutely.
Terrific. Dr. Tam Nguyen, thank you so much for joining us and shedding light on a very important issue right now.
Thank you for having me.
All right. And that is Insight for today. I'm Randall White, producers Cynthia Lopez, Kyle McKinnon, and of course, managing editor Aram Sarkissian. We'll catch you back here tomorrow.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.